rise, please. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The Supreme Court of the State of Idaho is now in session pursuant to law.
Thank you, everyone. Please be seated. Good morning. Welcome to the Ness First County Courthouse, where the Idaho Supreme Court is holding its April term today. We welcome all who are visiting and joining us today. This case is entitled Bradbury v. City of Lewiston. John Bradbury is present representing himself. And the respondent city is represented by Bethany Stromberg, as well as Andrew Pluskel, who is appearing only. You will also note that Justice John Stegner has recused himself in this case. And in his place, we have Pro Tem Judge Lamont Burris, who will participate fully as a Pro Tem Justice of this court for this case. Counsel, are there any preliminary matters in this case before we begin argument today?
Not for me, Your Honor.
No purpose, though.
Very well. Mr. Bradbury, you may proceed. You may proceed, sir. I'm sorry, I need to speak up, buddy.
Well, if the court please, if I learned anything in the last 50-some years, is that context matters. And I've never handled a case where context was more important than this case, I don't think. I guess the first question that I ask myself and I put to you is, why would a city use utility fees as taxes? And I think that this court put its finger right on it in Hillview when it said, in fact, the city raised its rates for water and sewer services so that it would not have to take the politically unpopular route of raising taxes. As you know, there's a 3% limit on raising taxes, property taxes. But using the utility fees does, it allows them to either reduce it less than 3 and say, we're saving you money, make up the difference with utility fees, or do the 3% and then use utility fees to fund the other projects they want that would exceed the 3%. So I think it's really important in this case to take a look at how the city has handled this whole situation. This court in Lewiston School District case specifically held in 2011 that it was unconstitutional for the city of Lewiston to use storm drain fees to repair Idaho streets. Specifically held that was an unconstitutional tax. So what was the city's response? It continued to use user fees, rate fees, from the other three utilities. Didn't stop them from taking fees from garbage, water, and sewer. So the message was from this court was clear. That's an illegal tax, a unconstitutional tax. But it didn't deter them from using that same procedure with their other three utilities. And so then what happens next? The city attorney gives them an opinion that using the utility fees for street repair is unconstitutional. Now what do? They ignore her. Then they have, then I, as a counselor, as a lawyer, advise them that I think it's unconstitutional. They ignore me. Then the district court, in this case, decides that holds that it's unconstitutional tax to use the water sewer and, well, actually just the sewer and the sanitation was an unconstitutional tax. And what did the city do? The city then, and it's difficult to believe, the city then says, well, we're going to add a 10% surcharge on the garbage collection. And then tells this court that the district court signed off on that as legitimate, when in fact the district court in its own opinion says it did not reach that question. But what it tells you which is 10% added surcharge added on to the garbage collection fee, is exactly the same practice that this court held was unconstitutional in Hill v. Home Park. That was precisely the same issue. And you held it was unconstitutional, but then they, after the court says it's unconstitutional to do that, this city then turns around, puts a surcharge on, says the judge approved it, when in his own opinion he said he didn't. So this is the rogue city that is not going to let this court tell it what to do, not let this district court tell it what to do. It has basically continued the practice since 2000, at least 2011. So that's the situation where we are today. And I would like to start off just briefly with initial issues, and I want to talk first of all with the memorandum of understanding on the loans. And in terms of those memorandum of understanding, is they take money from the sanitation utility, $2 million for the golf course, $800,000 for the library. They give it to those organizations, and they agreed, city agreed, to pay that money back in installments with interest over a fixed period of time. Now, neither the city nor the district court cited any authority for the fact that those were not contracts. And ignored the holdings of this court that they are contracts. And if you have those kinds of specifics in an agreement and they aren't contracts, what are they? Well, what the city says and what the district court held was they're transfers. And they say these were transfers of operational funds, operational reserves, just sent over. And as the district court said, it's like having the money in the bank account to draw interest. What the district court didn't say was that money had already been spent. It wasn't available. It wasn't in the bank account. It was spent. And the reason that that's important is because those loans were made in the first instance because the city could not afford to finance them during the fiscal year in which they was authorized. And somehow they would have you believe, the district court believe, that if they were callable, they could repay it even though they couldn't afford to finance it when they took the loans. And that was the reason for the loans. So what we have, and then, make, in my judgment, to make it worse, they say, city says, district court held, that transferring those fees was legitimate under the statute that permitted, decided 50-10-14, that permits the transfer of fund balances. That statute does permit that. But what it doesn't, what the state, what the city didn't say, and what the district court ignored, was that same statute as a specific provision at 1005A that says you can only transfer funds that are in excess of a liability in reserves. It specifically prohibits the transfer of reserves. And yet that city acknowledges that's what they did. Then the city says, and the district court held, that, well, we can call those at any time, so we don't have to worry about that. What they ignore is the fact that the memorandum itself says those loans were callable only for capital needs. Now, that's significant in two respects. One, it makes it almost impossible for them to call those, because there are basically no capital needs by the garbage collection. That's all just trucks picking up garbage, taking the transfer station and taking it from there to the landfill. Unlike the water and sewer processing plants that have high cap demands because of the treatment facilities that are involved. And so what we have here is a situation where they are simply not doing what I think that the law requires. And so, but it seems to me that in fairness to the district court and to you, that at least you were entitled to know that that section of the statute prohibited the transfer of reserves apply because it negated the very basis of the rationale for transferring the funds. And so I don't know how you can look at that statute and reach any other conclusion.
Well, the language between the two statutes is different, isn't it? 50-1005A refers to fund balances. 50-1014 just says unexpended balances can be transferred. It doesn't limit the transfer to unexpended fund balances.
Well, I think that it talks about... I don't have the wording. The fund balance is the exit. As long as it can only be called when necessary. Maybe a transfer of unexpended balance in one fund to the credit of another, unexpended balance. And then 105 says a fund balance in excess. So I think that it ties right in. 1014 says may transfer an unexpended balance in one fund to the credit of another. 1005A says a fund balance is the excess of assets of a fund over its liabilities and reserves.
Do you believe that statutes are in conflict with each other?
Excuse me?
Do you believe the statutes are in conflict with each other?
No, I think the statute, is not in conflict. It just simply defines what can be transferred, and it's only that amount of money that's in excess of the liability and reserves. And the other thing about that statute is if you look at it, the first part of the statute deals with city and city funds. So even if you think of transfer, I think we're talking about city funds. And then it goes on to create the utilities. And there it says you can only, it says fees that reflect the actual cost of providing services. So I don't think that you can, even if you assume that they're transferable, it only applies to city funds, not to utility fees. And what that does, if you decide otherwise, you conflate utilities with cities. And that's what the city and the district court did throughout this entire case.
Can I jump in? Quick question. Just more fundamentally, going back, you refer to these as loans, and then you said they're clearly contracts. And I'm just curious, if they're contracts, who are the contracting parties? Because when I look at the memorandum of understanding, it's the city signing it to themselves. So who are the contracting parties here?
Only if you assume that a utility is part of the municipality when, in fact, they are separately created statutorily, and they each have their own funding mechanisms, property taxes by the city, fees by the utility. They are totally, and that's where the confusion, I think, occurs in this case, is they conflict the two. And the standard of review that you've established when a city is dealing with its utilities is that inferences have to be drawn against the city. And there's a good reason for that. It's because those utilities are at the mercy of the governing body of the city. And so I think it's really important to understand, and if you look at the statutory structure of this, we have independent utility in this city. I can't imagine that they can come in and take money out of that and say, well, it's just a transfer. How can it be a transfer when you're agreeing to repay it with interest and installments that you've defined as a loan? That's your definition, not mine.
The memorandum of understanding characterizes this as an interdepartmental transfer of funds. Are you suggesting that the sanitation fund and the golf course fund are not two departments within the city?
The golf course fund and the library fund, yes, they are.
The sanitation
fund. Money comes from the sanitation fund.
Right. So you're suggesting the sanitation fund is not a department, so therefore this is not an interdepartmental transfer?
Oh, absolutely. And I don't think you can read the structure of how they set up. Look at what they do, what the statute, what the legislature has decided. sanitation utility, and they are callable at any time. When in fact, this memorandum of understanding says they're callable only for capital needs. And the city, the chief financial officer of the city says under oath, yes, they're only callable for capital needs. And then later, 3 months later, he signs an affidavit stating they're callable at will as operational funds. And that simply is contradicted by the memorandum of understanding itself.
Help me understand that contradiction. The memorandum I'm looking at, it says, when necessary for a capital project, the sanitation fund may call for the entire unpaid balance to be paid.
Right.
So how is that a contradiction?
Well, but they're saying we can call it for, even for operational needs. See, the thing that occurred here is that the sanitation utility has almost no capital needs. The other utilities, the sewer and water, are processing facilities that have high capital needs. And so when they say it can be callable only for capital needs, basically they're saying it's not callable at all. As a practical matter, it's not callable at all. And so that's the difference. And to say that it's callable when we're talking about fees, the statute says that utilities can only be funded, fees can only be assessed to the extent of the actual cost. We have almost $3 million that has been spent for a library and a golf course that has no relationship at all with the utility from which the money was taken. None. So that's the statutory structure. And then I want to move on just briefly to the remedies. The district court held that we weren't entitled to a remedy because they hadn't filed a notice of claim. The notice of claim was Exhibit 1 to my opposition to the city's motion to dismiss. The district judge concluded that there was no notice of claim when it was a part of the record, Exhibit 1 to my opposition. Therefore, the motion was brought to question standing. And the ability of us to pay. And the class clerk says, certify the class. I would like you to take a look at the Declaratory Judgment Act, which is Title Code 10-1201. And 1208 specifically says, further relief based on the declaratory judgment or decree may be granted whenever necessary or proper. That contemplates that there be a declaration of what the law is and requires until there's a cause of action. It's definitional. If the court decides and declares the law to be one thing, there may be a remedy. If they decide one another way, there may be a remedy. And to require a class certification when you don't even know if there's going to be a remedy puts the cart before the horse. Plus, the district court failed to follow your requirements that there be a reasoned conclusion as to why it's required. And Your Honor, I'd like to...
So just before you leave the remedies issue, are you seeking monetary damages, Mr. Bradbury?
Pardon?
Are you seeking monetary damages?
No.
Okay.
No. And that's... We're not. We're seeking recovery. That which gets to the point of whether or not notice of claim is required in these situations. And it's really important to understand that this is a replevant action. In Hillview, you decided that there was an illegal tax, it was an unconstitutional taking that required, so what we're asking is that those takings be refunded to the people that paid them. And let me suggest this to you. Equity developed under British law because in that law only monetary damages were available. Look at the remedies that are provided by equity. Specific performance, injunctions, mandate, writs of mandate. Now, why is an injunction given? another equitable remedy. Why is specific performance permitted? Because the damages aren't a remedy. So what you have in equity is you have them defining everything but damages. And I may have confused, because we're talking about money instead of sales of the vehicle. I mean, if we were trying to get to recover a vehicle, would you call that damages? That's what I mentioned. But because it's money, it's easy to think, well, that's damages because damages are usually answered in terms of funds. That isn't what we have here. There's, under the Hillview case, where you decided that illegal taxes, unconstitutional taxes, was and it taken under the 5th and 14th Amendments, were asking for their return. That's a repugnant action that you decided in A.L. Knowles' case was a possessory action. Repugnant, by definition, is possessory action. Damages are not possessory. That excludes, by definition, an act of damages action. So I suggest to you, and it's a question of first impression for you, because the cases that the city side simply don't apply. So I respectfully suggest that you decide that the notice claim is not required for an equitable action, and that can, in our complaint, in our petition, we ask for equitable remedies, and all we've ever asked for in that petition is for the money that was illegally taken under the 5th and 14th Amendment be returned to those who were taken. So that's an equitable action. And then we have the standing as
Before you leave that, so could you consider this restitution? Wouldn't that be an equitable remedy?
Restitution is an equitable. It could be restitution, it could be refund, either one. They're both equitable remedies. But the reason that equity was created in the first instance by the British courts was because it required modification of conduct. So you're talking about an injunction requiring them to do a specific act, prohibiting them from doing specific. Jury couldn't do that. All the jury could do at law was award monetary damages. And what we're asking for here is to regain possession of what you have said is an illegal taking of funds from Rick Garrison.
Can I follow up on that real quick?
Sure.
In your brief, you said, on your brief, page 32, you say, not once is there a request for a personal remedy. And so
That's right.
If I understand correctly, if this court, the district court determined you can't properly represent all of the taxpayers, this isn't a class action, if we decided that you can't represent the class as a whole, then you are not seeking your own personal remedy. Is that correct?
That's right. I brought this on behalf of the ratepayers. Okay. And I did it as an elected in two capacities. One, as an elected official, and two, as an oath taker. And which gets to the standing question. And the standing can be analyzed in two different respects. You have stated that one cannot take an oath as a public official and just stand by. So here I am on the city council. I see what the city attorney has called the unconstitutional. I do public records requests, find out what they're doing is unconstitutional. Tell them it's unconstitutional. They ignore me. So what am I required to do? Sit by and then just watch it continue? Or that oath require me to take additional steps? I suggest the latter. And the other approach that can be used is the Gifford case. Now, considering Gifford, where the parents of a child were trying to get their child into kindergarten and hadn't paid the fees that were being required, you found that there was an economic injury. But you did find was that the constitutional right to a free education was put at risk, and that gave standing. And this action wasn't brought by the child, it was brought by the parents. I was an elected official. I was bringing this on behalf of the ratepayers that elected me. And it's in that respect that I think I'm entitled to ask for remedies on their behalf as a public official. I, as an elected representative, am in a comparable position that the parent is to the child. And if it's not
chattel can't legally sue on its own behalf. The ratepayers can.
Not that they can legally, but not as a practical matter. The city has charged, the city's been charged $100,000 just through the trial, just through the district court. What ratepayer could possibly afford to pay $100,000 to vindicate the abuse of a rate that maybe amounts to only $200 or $300 for that ratepayer, but in an aggregate sense, in fact, is $5.5 million over the last 8 years. So while it's technically a liability, and I suppose you could have you could say they can. I can tell you this, that I had to be on the council for over 6 months before I could figure out what was going on. And not only then did I have to figure out that it was what was going on, but then the second step is I had to figure out that it was illegal. What ratepayer in the city of Lewiston wasn't on the council to figure that out? The example of that is the Lewiston School District case. They're the plaintiffs for the school district, Lewiston Clark State College, and the Port of Lewiston. They had funds. They have the ability. They have the ability to hire a sophisticated lawyer or afford a sophisticated lawyer. Even then, while they figured out that using the storm drain fees was unconstitutional, they missed the fact that they were charging the same, doing the same thing with the other three utilities, and didn't ask for their relief on that. And here you have a sophisticated lawyer acting on behalf of institutional clients. So where's the poor ratepayer going to get any relief as a practical matter, unless somebody like me has the ability to represent them in their interests? Can you imagine, if I hadn't brought this to you, can you imagine for a minute that this case would be before you for a decision?
Well, let me ask you, you've compared this several times to parent-child type of relationship and tried to draw an analogy there. Inasmuch as the city is a municipal corporation, wouldn't this more closely resemble, like say, a shareholder derivative act?
It could. It could. They're both acting in a representative capacity. So I wouldn't disagree with that. And, which, Your Honor, I'm not sure how to read this, but I think I only have seven.
Actually, I have three left. You're seven into your rebuttal.
Pardon?
You're 7 minutes into your rebuttal time.
You spoke
27
minutes. Well, then I just want to talk briefly about the lawyer's fees. Simply to state that I am not a layperson. The case that the city cited was where her lawyer withdrew, and she represented herself in a custody fight. I am not a layperson. I am a lawyer, and I'm acting on behalf of the citizens that represented me. And I suggest to you that if you don't let me act in that capacity, you will not be before this court.
What evidence is there that you are in an attorney-client relationship with the citizens of this community?
Well, because I fought with passion on behalf of the ratepayers.
But the ratepayers have to consent to you representing them, don't they? You can't just say you're someone's attorney and then they're your client.
Well, if that's the case, then you never have a class action.
Well, but class actions have certification proceedings that take care of that, don't they?
Not really. All the class action does is identify who they are. And it isn't a matter of them not being represented. If I can't act on behalf of ratepayers, then who can? Then they're without any remedy at all. Zero. And if equal justice under the law is only what justice you can afford, there's no justice at all for the average ratepayer. Little Jones, who doesn't have any money and doesn't have any legal sophistication, we wouldn't be here.
Well, I think Justice Mueller's point is you could have gotten some representative plaintiffs and you could have certified a class.
I don't think it's proper for me as a lawyer to go looking for a client.
Doesn't that happen in class action suits all the time, where you're looking for people that
class action usually
isn't the whole purpose of a class action suit is getting people to enlist that will be representative of the class you represent.
But it starts by a few of the people who have been wrong coming to the lawyer and asking for representation. And that's where it starts. It isn't, I mean, it isn't the lawyer out calling somebody into the office and say, I'll represent you, and then we'll get other people involved. If I can't bring it on behalf of the citizens of Lewiston, I repeat, who can?
Good morning, and may it please the court, I'm going to address 10 issues, time permitting. I'll try to be efficient and brief, but these are what I see as the high points in the case. Initially, I need to emphasize that the street impact fee, the central issue in this case, is no more. The city was charging a street impact fee to sanitation, water, wastewater, related to use of the roads. Mr. Bradbury challenged it. He argued in front of the district court. The district court said, sorry, city, I see your point, but you're wrong. Right? So they said, the district court said, this is not a permissible fee. It's a disguised tax. We disagree, but we respect the district court's decision. We have not appealed it. The judgment says we cannot charge it. It's over. So the central issue in this case, the street impact fee, is no more. Second, the district court was correct in ordering no monetary relief related to the street impact fee. Mr. Bradbury was the only petitioner in this case. There were no other petitioners. He purported to bring it on behalf of others similarly situated, but that's not enough. Under this court's case law, I'm talking about the Bettweiser case, 154 Idaho 317, which unfortunately was not cited in our brief, but I came upon it for credit for this. Just simply saying that you're bringing a case on behalf of others similarly situated is not sufficient to give you the ability to recover for others similarly situated. You must go through the class action process. You must go through the Rule 77 process in order to recover for someone other than yourself. It's absolutely undisputed that Mr. Bradbury did not do that in this case. He filed no motion for class certification. Therefore, the district court was entirely correct in saying, you can't recover for other people. We're going to focus only on you. So now let's go to Mr. Bradbury's personal remedies. I had some arguments directed toward this point. The necessity of filing a notice of tort claim, the necessity of bringing that notice of tort claim to the court's attention rather than assuming the court's going to comb the entire file looking for something after the court raised the issue. But that's now unnecessary, isn't it? Mr. Bradbury just told you that he is not seeking any personal remedy whatsoever. So the district court ruled that the street impact fee was wrong. We're not challenging that. The district court ruled that there was no class action certification motion, so Mr. Bradbury could not recover on behalf of anyone but himself. And Mr. Bradbury just told you that he doesn't want a remedy for himself. So there was a mistake. The mistake has been corrected, but there's no basis for any monetary award related to that mistake. Third,
assuming we find that Mr. Bradbury hasn't waived his right to recover, can you address why under Hillview we should apply the Tort Claims Act and bar recovery for him?
Because you have to look at the Alpine case and the Hare, H-E-H-R case, both involved the city of McCall, both applied the Tort Claims Act provisions to claims for an unconstitutional fee or an unconstitutional take. So those cases read together stand for the proposition that you must file the tort claim process. The Hillview case dealt with the immunity under 6-904A. It didn't deal with any other issue. It said that because the fee that they imposed in Hillview was really a I was taxed, but it wasn't a collective tax, that 6904A did not apply. That's the only holding in the W that's applicable. That's applicable regarding the tort claims act. If you look at Alpine, if you look at CARE, it's clear that you have to file the notice of tort claim, follow the notice of tort claim process. And that was not done properly in this case, and it certainly wasn't pointed out to the court. And the court inquired on that issue during the order.
And do you think those cases are all reconcilable with each other?
I think so. I think you need to flesh it out a little bit more. I think you can look at them at first blush and say, there's some more work that needs to be done here to reconcile these cases, but certainly Hillview did not overrule Alpine. Hillview did not overrule CARE. I don't believe that Hillview even cited those cases, although that could be wrong on that.
But certainly Hillview calls into question those cases, doesn't it?
You could argue that it implicitly does, at least regarding federal claims, not regarding state claims. Third, if it's okay, I'll move on to standing. Mr. Bradbury has no standing at all to challenge any water-related issues. Mr. Bradbury, admittedly, although belatedly admittedly, is not a City of Water or City of Lewiston water customer. He's a customer of the Lewiston Orchards Irrigation District. He gets his water from them, not from the city. So he was not impacted personally whatsoever by the city's allegedly improper water practices. He has no individualized injury. He hasn't even claimed an individualized injury. So under classic standing principles, he has no standing to challenge the water issues.
Does the fact that he was a member of the city council imbue him with any special authority? We've already talked about there's no class action certification in this case. So I was talking just specifically about the fact that he was a member of the city council. Does that change our analysis at all?
Well, it moves you into a different realm. It moves you into the legislative standing analysis. And there's case law that we discussed and that's been developed on this issue. Legislative standing only exists when you're protecting the institution, when there's been some institutional injury. If they had closed the door to the city council chambers and refused to let him come in and participate, if they refused to let him vote, perhaps there would be some institutional injury that would give him standing to challenge the city's actions. That's not the case here. He was a member of the city council. He debated the issue. He voted on the issue. He did not prevail. That does not give him legislative standing.
This is a little different, though, than someone being outvoted on a city council issue and then being sore about it, they're suing because they didn't like the outcome of the vote. This was dealing more with his concerns about the processes and procedures that the city was operating under. In other words, this wasn't necessarily the fact that he was lost out on a vote, but it was dealing with the basic structure of how the city ran itself financially. Did that change it at all?
No, it does not. His concerns regarding the city practices, if he had been a ratepayer, they would give him personal standing. He was not a ratepayer, so he did not have personal standing. The only other entree would be legislative standing, which, as I believe I discussed in explaining the brief, the threshold was not met in this case.
So you don't think that deciding to impose an illegal street impact fee causes institutional damage?
Deciding to impose it causes institutional damage?
No, that his decision to pursue this action, to challenge this constitutional fee or unconstitutional fee, that that's pursuing a practice that would injure the institution.
No, I do not. We have a body of case law dealing with legislative standing. If every time you, a city councilor or a member of the legislature, disagreed with action taken by the legislative body, they had standing, it would throw our democratic process on its head. We have a mechanism, we have voting, we have debate, but you don't get to challenge legislative action because you disagree with it or even because you consider it unconstitutional just because you're a member of that body. standing to argue about them. For his briefing, not today, I'm sure he didn't have time, he complains about the city providing water to the golf course and to other city entities at little or no fee. There's absolutely nothing wrong with a city providing water to itself for little or no fee. There's nothing wrong with providing water for public purpose for little or no fee. There's nothing wrong with providing water to a cemetery without charging the cemetery fund for the water. There's nothing wrong with providing water to flush fire hydrants without charging the fire department or the water used to flush the fire hydrants. There's nothing wrong with allowing the fire department to put out fires without charging the fire department for the water used to put out the fires. There's nothing wrong with providing water to a public golf course at little or no cost because that's for a public purpose. It's the city's water. The city can use it for a public purpose and charge or not charge as it sees fit for those public purposes. So there's nothing wrong with what the city did with respect to golf course water. It's perfectly permissible. No statute prohibiting it, no ordinance prohibiting it. Transfers from the sanitation fund to the golf and library funds were permissible. First, I have to point out that he misstated it. It was not $2 million to the golf course, it was $1.1 million. So we're talking about $2 million, not $3 million. Second, the library transfers were fully repaid. That's in the affidavit of Dan Marsh, declaration of Dan Marsh. So that's no longer an issue. Next, the sanitation fund and the golf course fund are not, contrary to what Mr. Bradley says, separate legal entities. There is no separate legal entity known as the City of Lewiston Sanitation Fund.
But why do we have a memoranda of agreement, and why do we have interest? I mean, those things all look and smell like loans between separate entities.
Transfers between separate entities. I think the purpose of the interest was to provide some rate of return for this fund that was giving virtually no rate of return. Why do we have a memorandum of understanding? Just to show, have a piece of paper showing what was done. Otherwise, perhaps you would not be able to explain what was done and why it was done. We have a piece of paper saying, this is what we did in life.
Why the interest? I mean, I struggle with that, too. This is one city. These are different departments. The statute, if it's truly a transfer within one governmental entity, why isn't it just noting on its books, okay, I'm transferring this here, and then if they want to make a note about it, I'm going to repay this much of it every month and do that, but why the interest if it's all city money?
So it was me. I probably wouldn't have done the interest thing either. But it wasn't me. It was transferred from one pocket to another, and for whatever reason, the city administrators at that time thought it was fair for the golf fund and library fund to repay the sanitation fund with some level of interest. Why? I can't tell you. Why? It's not the record. I can only surmise that they thought it was fair and able.
Taking a step back, Mr. Bradbury characterizes this as not an interdepartmental transfer, which I think is a very different thing. He characterizes it as a transfer between a department and a utility, which he claims is legally separate and can't be treated as an interdepartmental transfer. Specifically, as to his claim that the sanitation fund represents a utility and not a city department, how would you respond?
Yeah, I would respond by asking, where's the statute that says the sanitation fund is a separate legal entity, separate and distinct from the city? There is none. By statute, the sanitation fund is the city. It's controlled and run by the city. All the employees of the sanitation fund are city employees. The city council governs the sanitation fund. It's just a city department, like any other city department.
Does the city of Lewiston, are they so
separate legal entity outside the city of Lewiston. That's called a utility. There's no separate governing body. There's no statute or other provision saying that if you establish a utility, the utility has its own unique existence and can sue or be sued. It simply doesn't exist that way. If these are really just enterprise funds. You won't find in the statute saying there's a city you can establish a separate legal utility. It's not there. These are separate pots of money controlled by the same entity. The city is all the city. There's no separate entity at all. It's one pocket to another pocket. It's an accounting issue within a single governmental entity.
But those enterprise funds have very strict, they're strictly regulated by the legislature, right? I mean, there are real constraints on what can be done with that money. I mean, they don't get moved over to the city for general fund purposes, right?
Correct. Yes, there are constraints on certain enterprise funds, not the golf fund, because that's not covered specifically by the statute. The library fund, because that's not covered specifically by the statute.
But sanitation, sewer?
There are restrictions. Yes, there are.
Well, and if you could address, as I understood part of Mr. Bradbury's argument, it was that the enterprise funds don't even fall under 50-1014 because they're different kinds of funds. So can you address that argument?
That's not the way the statute reads, at least the way I read it. It says one fund to another fund. It doesn't say those funds governed by the Idaho Revenue Bond Act. Doesn't limit the definition in that manner. It just talks about funds. It doesn't limit it to water funds, street funds, sanitation funds. It's just funds. So, moving on to
before we move out of that issue, if the city moves $2 million out of those funds, pursuant to a memorandum of understanding that the city is going to repay that transfer with interest, is it reasonable to infer that that money was not needed as any type of prudent reserve for those funds?
No.
Why not?
Not without evidence. The evidence in this record from Mr. Yardici under Mass Prison Manual, he submitted a declaration after examining the city funds. And said, in fact, the city funds are underfunded. Just because there's a balance in the fund does not by definition make the fund overfunded. You have a balance because you've got a plan for contingencies. You've got a plan for the future. For example, Lewiston just had a storage reservoir which collapsed, a calamity. You've got to be able to plan for those calamities, so you carry a balance in your fund. So merely having a balance in your fund does not mean that the fund is overfunded, that the money there was not necessary. You have to plan for contingencies. You have to have a reserve.
Can you speak to his argument that 50-1005A limits the amount that could be transferred to the amount in excess of the fund's liabilities and reserves?
I think the statutes must be read together, and I think the problem there is that the term reserve is not defined. So it's got to be the amount in excess of the needs and reserves. But what are the reserves? It's not defined by statute. Also, you have to keep in mind that this is a temporary transfer of funds. It's not a permanent transfer of funds. It's a temporary transfer of funds, which...
20 years, right?
What?
20 years is the term.
Up to. Could be 18 months. Statutes are difficult to read together. I think they need to be, but there is an inherent difficulty there, and I think it comes from the lack of definition of the word reserves. So, moving on to the Valley Vision contracts, or the Hudson Valley. Visit Valley Vision and Visit LC Valley contracts. He claims that they're donations, but they're not. the city entered into separate contracts with each of these entities for services, services including assisting in recruiting and retaining businesses, workforce development, creating a strategic plan, economic development, and tourism strategy. For many years, those contracts were oral, but in 2018, we were using written contracts in the court records of each of those entities, laying out the services they need to provide and what they need to do to satisfy the contracts, including explaining to the city every year what they've done with the city's money, how they have performed the contract. Promoting tourism and economic development are legitimate city functions. The city could have hired someone in-house to do the same thing. It would be perfectly legitimate for the city to hire a director of tourism or a director of economic development and fund that position. The city chose instead to contract with a third party to provide the services. There's nothing wrong with doing that. It's no different than contracting with a third-party mechanic to maintain the city's vehicles. Perfectly okay. It's no different than the city renting a billboard that says, visit Lewiston. Perfectly okay. It's no different than the city hiring me to represent them. I'm a third party. It's not a donation to pay my fees. I provide a service. Valley Vision provides a service pursuant to a contract. These plainly are not donations, as the district court concluded. Eighth, the attorney-client memos. These were clearly, under seal on the record, you can look at them. These were clearly communications from the city lawyer to the city manager regarding legal issues she saw. The mark is privileged. They were not disclosed. The privilege was not waived. Only the city council could waive the privilege. And so they clearly are privileged. They should never have been included in the record. They should never have been referred to by Mr. Bradbury. And the district court's decision on that should be affirmed.
I had a question about that.
You bet.
When Mr. Bradbury sued the city, he said in his capacity as a city council member, did he effectively sue himself?
And by the way, he sued the entity. I think every lawsuit against an entity is not, by definition, a lawsuit against the entity's elected representatives. So, thinking about it now for the first time, I would say he does not sue
I'm just saying, like, as a member of the city council, like, technically, even today, you represent him, correct?
He's not a member of the city council.
When you began your representation?
I represent the entity, not the individual elected officials of the entity.
I guess what I'm getting at is it seems strange that the city council person could sue the city council, receive legal advice from the city attorney, and then use it against the city.
If that circumstance was present, that would truly be odd and not correct. That's not what happened in this case. He didn't seek the legal advice. The legal advice was given in response to issues spotted by the city attorney that she thought she needed to bring to the attention of the city manager. Mr. Bradbury had access to those memos because he was a member of the city council. He had the right to see them. He didn't have the right to disclose them. He did not have the right to waive the privilege on behalf of So, moving on to attorney's fees. Mr. Bradbury claims he was entitled to attorney's fees below. The attorney fee decision turns initially on who's the prevailing party. This court has made clear that the prevailing party determination is a matter of the district court's discretion. The district court looked at the outcomes in the case, determined that both parties prevailed in part, both parties lost in part, and determined that overall there was no prevailing party. There's no basis in this record for finding that the district court abused its discretion in that regard. So he's not entitled to return to that reason alone. There are other reasons as well.
Well, stop for just a second.
Yeah.
I mean, our case law doesn't say we necessarily apply a scorecard and say, well, he lost on eight issues and I think it's a little more complex than that, and especially where it's a, albeit very learned, but still a pro se litigant. If they sue to stop an unconstitutional tax, and they do, even though they lost on a bunch of other issues, it's hard to say they didn't prevail because they did stop something from happening, and not only to his benefit, but I'm sure he would say on behalf of all the citizens of the city.
I agree it's not a scorecard. I agree the court's case law doesn't make it into a scorecard issue. But there is a requirement that the district court determine an overall, whether there is an overall prevailing party. He raised, what, 9 issues? Prevailed on 1. We prevailed on 8. And it's not a scorecard, but you have to take both scenarios into account. We prevailed on a lot of things. We prevailed on a significant issue, no doubt about it. The district court was charged with looking at that and saying, overall, who was the prevailing party? He prevailed on some things, we prevailed on some things. Overall, there was no prevailing party, according to the district court. And there's nothing that makes that an abuse of discretion. The district court had the discretion to make that judgment, and it did. Next, the case law provides very clearly that pro se litigants, even attorneys, cannot recover attorney's fees. It's bedrock principle of Idaho law. Third, the part of the attorney general doctrine, I don't even know what the status of that is in Idaho anymore. You have cases which say that it's not applicable, that 12-117 or 12-121 now control instead of the private attorney general doctrine, but last year you avoided the fees under the private attorney general doctrine. So I really don't know what the status of that is right now. In any event, he has to be the prevailing party. Under 12-117 and 12-121, which are potentially applicable, he has to show that the city's conduct was unreasonable, had no basis of law or fact. The district court disagreed with the city's decision, but it was not an unreasonable decision. It had some basis of law and fact. The city believed that heavy trucks tear up the streets, therefore people who benefit the use of those heavy trucks, the garbage trucks, should pay a portion of the fee. We were wrong, but we were not unreasonable in that regard. And finally,
before we go, I'm just curious about your comments about the questionable viability of the private attorney general doctrine. We awarded those in the Reclaim Idaho case recently.
That's what I was talking about.
In 2002, I know because I got them, this court awarded attorney's fees in an election challenge. I was the prevailing attorney in that case. So I'm just wondering why you believe there may be no real private attorney general action still viable in Idaho.
Well, there are two cases, and I don't have them on my fingertips, but if you Westlaw them, Westlaw private attorney general, you'll find the most recent case that you just talked about, you'll find another one from about 3 or 4 years ago, which says that it's no longer viable, that fees have to be awarded pursuant to 12-117 or 12-121. I can't make this up.
But isn't it more the nature of the action? For example, this is a case where essentially a deck action against the city, those traditionally are under 12-117, aren't they?
Yes. I think if you're going to analyze these issues, you're going to be focused on some of these things. Final point regarding attorney's fees, and probably my final point overall, is how could the district court award him any attorney fee whatsoever? He submitted no Rule 54 showing. He didn't say how much time he spent. He didn't show what his hourly rate was. He didn't included no discussion whatsoever upon which the district court can make a judgment as to what a reasonable fee would be. On the district court's record, we just have been pulling a number out of the air. It's just impermissible. You can't review a number out of the air. And I'll also point out further that, to my knowledge, any showing he made regarding attorney's fees at the district court level is not in this court's record. I looked for it. I didn't see it. There's no basis for no ability for you to review that issue. With that, of course, thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Trumberg. Madam Clerk, the panel has no time, correct? Very well then, Cassie. Mr. Bradbury, We thank you for your argument and effort in this case. The matter is now under advisement. The court will, in due course, make a decision. We will now be in recess. Thank you very much.
All rise, please.